you very much. I'm sorry to make you all monocular rather than binocular, because I'm going to write on the board. It's a Fields Institute. I think somebody has to write on the board. This is a workshop. Oh. And also, I would like to have 10 minutes for a discussion with the audience, so if you could warn me when I have 10 minutes left. Because I think at the end of the abstract, I promised that we'll end with a discussion of HEB satellite assemblies. We are in Canada. HEB is Canadian. I think we need to have a discussion of HEB satellite assemblies. So yeah, let's get started. This is a bit of a deviation from the talks, because I analyze data. I'm a data miner. Happens to be dabbling a little bit in neuroscience. And the talk that I'm going to have today, since this is a workshop, I will not quote any of my papers. If people are interested, you can contact me. I'll give you a contact. I will not quote anyone else's papers either. So I will not compare my results with anyone else's. This is a workshop. I think we can get away with that. For those of you who are wondering what my first name and last name is, that's my first name. First four letters of the long name. I'm from the other side of the pond in the U.S., and let's get started. What am I interested in? Suppose you have a complex dynamical system with, let's say, thousands of variables, but let's make it hundreds of variables for the workshop, okay? Which to me are nodes of a graph. And from some of those nodes, activation data is available. So that's my data. From the data stream, how do we infer the graph structure of the system? I'll come to what do I mean by this thing. And also, if this graph changes with time, how do I track this as it evolves in time? Okay? And I would like to do this thing with a minimal knowledge of the system, because I don't want to get into the thing of model validation, because there are plenty of good people in model validation. I don't want to be the 32nd person in model validation, so I would like to do this thing with a minimal knowledge of the system. So essentially, data stream for me looks like this. It could be hundreds of channels of data. Things turn on and turn off at points in time. Okay. Aspects of the graph structure that I would like to infer. Who influences whom in terms of nodes? What is the sign and strength of these influences? And also, I would like to know what are the delays between the nodes. Okay? If I can get that much for a large graph, I'm happy. But you'll see at the end, I'm nowhere close to being happy. So at the end of the day, I could get from some data that I got that there's a graph of this sort. These are all directed graphs. I've shown only acyclic graphs. It could be cyclic. I would like to get the delay between, say, U and X, and also the influence of U on X. We'll see that later as a conditional probability. With that being said, in neuroscience, things are very simple. You can get the spike trains very beautifully, thanks to all the people in this audience. There are all kinds of ways neural data is becoming available. I don't get into the kitchen. I don't want to see how you guys cook your things. I just want clean data, and then I analyze it. Okay? So there will be no discussion of the kitchen per se, just the nice things that... No, those of you who are into spike sorting know what I'm saying. Yeah. I see smile. Oh, okay. I'm just being honest there because this is a workshop. Okay? Because I only deal with people who give me spike sorted data, because I don't want to get into their spike sorting and how we generate the spikes from calcium signals and this and that. Okay. So thanks to all the nice people, some of them in the audience, there are all kinds of ways you can get data. Okay. You saw probes, you saw things being grown on electrode arrays, calcium imaging, all kinds of other things. I guess the next talk is, yeah, we should have reversed the order of the talk, so because you're going to talk all about calcium imaging. But the state of analysis is a little bit pathetic. If you look at the fairly influential paper by Brown, Katz, and Mitra, they say simultaneous recording of multiple spike trains from several neurons offers a window into how neurons work together, blah, 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 blah. Without substantial methodology research in future, our ability to understand this function will be significantly hampered, blah, blah, blah. That means people like me will continue to be employed for the next 10 or 15 years. Okay? Because famous people have said so in 2004. Yeah. Okay. So let me introduce the concept in kind of two different systems. Okay? This is C. elegans. Who all know C. elegans? Only one? Two? Because you had to learn something, Siv, from C. elegans. Because Sidney Brenner wrote a two-page proposal, I think to Max Perutz, I forget who he wrote the proposal to, simply saying, I want to study this worm, give me, I forget how many million pounds, and he did get it. So for CMM, you need to make a similar proposal that's compelling to somebody. I don't know who Max Perutz is over here. But the C. elegans has only about 300 neurons, has only about 900 cells. People have studied to death all the development and so on. But there's only about 300 neurons. And again, very clever people are coming up with ways of recording from these, at least the motor neurons and so on, and even activating and deactivating and that kind of thing. And pardon me, don't nitpick me, C. elegans neurons don't spike, but they have calcium signals. Okay? They don't have sodium channels, so they don't spike. They evolved before the sodium channels evolved. So if I or we can get spike-like data from the 300 C. elegans neurons, the question is, can we then get the graph structure of the connectivity between the 300 neurons and track them in real time when the darn thing is learning something or doing various things? This graph that I'm showing over here is heroic work of John White over 10 years, who sat with a microscope and stained serial sections when he was way back in England. Now he's in Wisconsin. So this is 10 years of very painful work in anatomy. So the question is that, can we get this thing from physiology? And if the worm is doing various things, can we then change, can we then track the changes? So this thing has about 300 nodes of the graph. So this is just to motivate you. We are nowhere close to getting that kind of things, even data, let alone the analysis. Okay? So here's a simple system. If we can monitor all 300 neurons, can we get the graph out and can we track the changes in terms of connectivity, strength of connectivity, and things of that sort? Okay? That's a simple thing. Let me now complicate my life a little bit more. These are called Bengalese finches, and they sing in finite state grammar. Okay? What do I mean by that? Yeah, I think those of you who are at least a little bit computer science savvy know what finite state grammar is. If I take the acoustic waveform of this thing, there are prototypical patterns. For example, if I call this thing an A, then there are three A's over here, and then if I call this thing a B and a C and a D and E and that kind of thing, there are only finite number of symbols. And you can get the transition probabilities for the symbols for this kind of thing. And these darn birds, they pass on this thing from father to son, and they sing exactly the same way. The little regional accents and so on. So here's the Bengalese fringes finite state grammar. Suppose, okay, stop your bird. Okay. Suppose if I record from I, meaning I don't record, my collaborator, record from large number of neurons in the song production. This is song production slash recognition area of the finch's brain, here's the bird brain. Then the question is that, through various means, can I get anything close to the graph that I see in the acoustic space? This might be maybe my daughter's generation that'll solve this thing, maybe not my generation, okay? But these are the kind of questions that we would like to ask and, if possible, answer part of the way. Okay? Are you all with me? Yeah? Okay. So what is the simple way we are going to get to these things? So suppose, say, my graph looks like this, and I have alphabetic neurons A through Z, and it just so happens that some random sequence in the neuron S talks to the neuron I, which tends to talk to neuron V, tends to talk to neuron A. Okay? So these are all strong positive influences. Then, in my data, so let's say that's a blue pattern, I will see whenever S fires, I will most likely fire after that, V will most likely fire after that, A will most likely fire after that, and so on. So if I can find patterns of this sort, or patterns of this sort, I can get then some edges of the graph from patterns in the data. So essentially what we do is data mining of the spike trains to find significant patterns of the data, and then we revert them back into graphs. I will only in this talk talk about positive influences. We can also do similar things with negative influences. Ask me later, I will tell you. So, but why is this task difficult? Why isn't every Tom, Dick, and Harry doing it? Even famous mathematicians, you know, Eugene Nisikovich, I think some of you might know, there are a large number of CPU cycles being wasted, or spent, I should say, simulating Nisikovich's neural networks for various things. He says that finding groups of neurons using only statistical analysis of spike trains is practically impossible, so on and so forth. Why he's saying is for the following reason. Suppose I record from 1,000 neurons, and you want to evaluate all pairwise interactions. Then all of a sudden, you need to evaluate 1,000,000 interactions, okay? The signal-to-noise ratio of people who have done two-point correlations of large spike trains and so on, you'll see that from two-way interactions, you don't get much signal-to-noise ratio, okay? But if you go to patterns that are higher and higher, let's say all three-way interactions are looked at and evaluated, you will get much higher signal-to-noise ratios. I will come to that in a second as to, you know, in the real data. So if you want to evaluate all eight-way interactions and that kind of things, all of a sudden you are in the large numbers, and Isakovich says that it's impossible. Now what I would like to explain to you is how we in the data mining world captures this thing of curse of dimensionality. So suppose I have, for the time being, let's say 26 is a large number. So I have neurons A through Z. Okay. So suppose, say, you count the number of firings of all A through Z, and then there is some way of throwing out those that are insignificant. I will not get to one node things for the time being. But let's say from this thing, I create all ABs, A followed by B, A followed by C, 26 by 26 things. And suppose that there's a way to count every one of them, how many times they occurred in the data stream. And suppose, say, then I see that only Yemeni of them are significant. So all of a sudden, I have cut down Yemeni things from going to the next step. So then on the next step, I generate all A followed by B followed by C's and things of that sort, and I count them all and drop all insignificant ones, okay? All the things that I'm showing you so far is only for sequential patterns. Again, for today's discussion, I'm going to stick to sequential patterns. There are patterns of this sort we can count, which is A and B and C and D co-occurring together. Even A or B followed by C. This is what we call partial order. This is what we call no order. This is what we call total order. We have for all these things ways to count them and determine the statistical significance in the background. So that's how we can prove Isakovich wrong. Okay. Now if I can find that thing. Oh, I have two. The way we do that is that we are clever counting people. We stick in the computer science world. We count the number of occurrences of these kind of things, and then what we do is that for the kind of countings that we do, we build statistical models, and from the statistical models we get probabilities and all kinds of other nice things, and we connect likelihoods with the counts. So we can stay very nicely in the computer science world. We don't have to do any nasty things in the stat world, and from counting we can essentially get likelihoods. So I'll show you one or two examples of how we do it. Okay? So that's the game we play. Are you all with me at this point? Yeah? Okay. So this is just to show you how we actually count. We count using finite state automaton. If people are interested, we have a bunch of papers on this thing because we are computer scientists. So this is roughly how we do it. Suppose I'm counting Siva. Sorry, Siva, I added an A to the end of your name, because then I can make a four-node episode. Then when S comes, it's expecting the next symbol that it's looking for, and so on and so forth. And so you can have an army of finite state automaton sitting around and doing the counting at each level. Then I get all the counts. Then I throw out all the insignificant ones. I generate candidates at the next level, again go through this thing, count them all, and go my merry way. Two things that are seven and. So how do I now connect? So the counting that I haven't come to kind of delays at this point, so it's simply order that I'm talking about. Suppose I've counted now some S followed by I followed by V followed by A, how do I get the significance of that? So this is another piece of work that we did over the last few years. We can essentially create equivalent hidden Markov models. So let's see one hidden Markov model. So this hidden Markov model has four special states that I call episode states, and there's a whole bunch of states that I call noise states. So if we can now cook this HMM of this peculiar kind, it's a very trivial HMM with only a parameter eta over here. It's the same for all. We have done generalizations of this. If people are interested, ask me later. And then the number of states. So you can think of this HMM being cooked over and over again, and then you'll see that patterns of this thing will come out of this. Okay? So what I'm counting are essentially patterns of this sort, the one shown in green. So then, using this kind of HMMs, we can have all kinds of nice results. For example, we can calculate the probability that a given sequence, given the model lambda, and then it can do all kinds of things. The only thing I would like to show you from this graph is this is my noise parameter eta. And let's just look at this little line. On this, okay, so let me tell you what these graphs are. This is theoretically calculated values for likelihoods on a log scale. This is for a noise model where I have no episode states. Remember, the episode states in the previous thing are these states that generate the symbols that I'm interested in the count. And the noise states have a probability of emitting any symbol. So in this part of the world for eta, I am hopeless, meaning even a noise model is as likely as any of the other models. But in this part of the world where eta is below a certain amount, I can prove all kinds of theorems, not even I, my collaborators, I have smart collaborators. We can prove theorems such as this. For example, if there were two episodes, say alpha and beta. Say alpha is these are both let's say four node is say, and say beta is okay. If the count of alpha is greater than beta, we can prove that the likelihood of lambda alpha is greater than the likelihood for lambda beta, and the other way around, and so on. And this can be now reduced to significant tests, where you can reject essentially nulls of independence with respect to type 2 errors. Epsilon over here is my type 2 error. Okay. So again, the take-home lesson is that by creating kind of a statistical equivalence to the counts that I'm doing. You can now play around in this world, but I don't need to evaluate any of these things. I can simply count away, and I can attach significance to my counts, throw away all insignificant ones, and move on. Okay? But in the neuroscience world, we are a little better because we have delays, and we can make good estimates, or we can at least have good guesses about delays involved. Okay? In the HMM world, the only thing we can reject are nulls of independence. Here, we can even reject composite nulls. So we can actually rank order things based on the conditional probabilities. Okay. So the next few slides will show you that. Okay. So now I can actually think of getting some grip on unearthing network connectivity patterns, because here I can use delay as a handle, because a given nervous tissue tends to use certain neurotransmitters, and so we can get, so again, going to this SIF thing, These are time-constrained ones, so I can have patterns such as S followed by I within, say, 0 to 5 milliseconds delay, I to V followed with 5 to 10 millisecond delay, and that kind of thing. And the other nifty thing we can do is that if you know the neurotransmitters involved, you can give a bunch of delays that you're likely to encounter, and you can also discover the combination of best-fit delays in this system. Okay? So we are slowly getting there. Those of you who are interested in implementation, this is completely parallelizable. GPUs can be used to implement. It can be speeded up. So here again, you can model the counting process. So in this case, we can get the complete distribution of the function from all the from the moment generating function, and now the fits and so on that I'm going to show you is from data that are generated from Poisson models. So we have a network simulator. We have tested similar things with gamma. We need stability. We can also make estimates of how much data we need to make a estimate on the connection strength, or to distinguish two connection strengths with a certainty, we can estimate how much data is needed. But for that amount of time, we need stability in the system. Okay? And again, theoretical things and counter things look quite nice. So these curves become tighter and tighter when we go to patterns that are longer and longer. Okay? I didn't show the two-node thing. Two-node things will look much looser. Okay? So that's the benefit you get by going to longer and longer patterns in our world, or larger and larger graphs. Okay, remember Isakovich, the man said that it can't be done. So he has his own model. Those of you who know that, this is roughly an integrated fire model. Okay, I don't think I need to go into integrated fire model. And then another thing that he has is that he has synaptic plasticity. He implements STDP at individual synaptic level, and so on and so forth. And this thing has quite a bit of dynamics. Proof is in the pudding. Okay, so we ran large Isakovich networks, and then we asked, hey, how good is the value for the equivalent of the synaptic thing that he puts in versus what we get out? It's fairly good, I would say. So we have now tested it using a variety of models. Poisson, various binomial distributions, gamma models, and then Isakovich-type models. We can get the graph structures out fairly well. I used to work in the auto industry, so this relates to those days. But let me prove one point to you. If you recall, the length of the episode is in the denominator of that significance thing. So when the episodes get longer and longer, you need only small number of occurrences for those things to be significant. So here's an extreme case of that. I artificially inserted one single instance of 11 long pattern. This was simply GM beats Ford, not true anymore. But that single occurrence of that is significant. So if I can count all occurrences from 2 onwards, so here we don't have much of a computational advantage, but you can even find single occurrences of things that are significant at a combinatorially large space. Okay? So this is the thing that I was going to come to. So this is simply counts for various pattern lengths of the sub-patterns that made up that long sequence, GM beats Ford. So this is, for example, all the 3-node patterns. So here are the counts. When we go longer and longer, the counts get smaller and smaller, but the inferred conditional probabilities go higher and higher. So this is my random threshold right here. So say if you go beyond patterns of length 7 and so on, you can say that even 4 times randomness, I get the counts that I get is significant. Yeah? Okay? So that's the reason to go beyond pairwise correlation, is you get much better things. So this is, I'm going to now show you some things that we get in various systems. So this is Steve Potter and, well, let me say, just say Steve Potter's data, collected actually in Jerry Pine's lab at Caltech. They grow these neurons on these petri dishes. Okay, the thing that I want to tell you is the following. Okay, so in this system, they grow this. They keep it alive for 35 days. Okay, and so these are the days when they feed the darn system. Okay, it has, as we saw before, it has 59 electrodes. There are 59 spike trains that we look at. So on over here, I plot those 59 spike trains as relative spike counts on a log scale. Okay. From this, I can find two reliable circuits, one shown over here in blue and one shown over here in red. So this one is 1, 2, 3, 4 electrodes involved. This one has 3 electrodes involved. But the thing I want to tell you is the following. Look at the relative spike counts involved in that blue pattern. Okay, this is a log scale. So this is what I mean by going to longer and longer patterns. You can begin to track circuits with much fewer spikes involved in them than if you would have done it using pairwise correlations. So we haven't verified if these things are real circuits or not. So this is just to show you the benefits of going to longer and longer chains. Okay, as I said, we can generalize it to graphs. We just actually some collaborators of mine just finished the formalism that you might be able to get to dynamic Bayesian networks now from some counts that you're getting. Yeah. Again, I won't get to it today, but if people are interested, you can ask me. Okay. Naive things of this sort, when you actually go into the world, the graph has problems. So, for example, you can get all kinds of false edges because I'm just rejecting nulls based on type 2 errors. So one of the things we can do is that we can now begin to do this hypothesis testing at the kind of graph level. So this is to give you an example. Suppose I get a graph of this sort out, okay? Then I can have a whole bunch of alternate hypotheses and reject them based on counts. This particular thing is fairly loose. Now we have actually tightened this hypothesis testing. So we can now begin to take this thing to kind of a graph level, and we can now begin to conquer things actually from a graph kind of thing. So this is to show you that I should be, I am able to follow some time-involving network. What I did is that we have 26 neurons, and every 5 seconds I change the network. So 0 to 5 seconds, this was the network involved, and then I change one of the nodes, and so on and so forth. And then the next thing, you will see that when I move my a little 5 second window around, and then infer the graph. I'm sorry for the poor quality of this figure. So these are the 26 spike trains, and I also plot on it the significant episodes. That those are these patterns that I get out of that, and this is the graph that we infer from it. Just to play that thing one more time, you can see that when I had artificially put in these graphs in there, every 5 seconds the graph changes. But 5 seconds of data in this system is enough for me to reliably infer the graphs, and so when that graphs change, I can track the system in time. This is another little bit of real data. This is Lauren Frank's data that I'm analyzing with Ann Smith at UC Davis. Another aim here is also there are umpteen number of people doing model validation in the field, so we wanted to directly compare how well do we do with, say, generalized linear models and various other things of that sort, okay? So, yeah, I think you all know that the rat learns to run the maze, okay, and then there are various place cells that fire when the rat is in various places, okay? But the take-home lesson is the following. So this is a network that we get using Bayesian GLM. This is a network I get from my data mining. Looks identical here. Takes 6 hours for Ann Smith to cook this thing. This takes me 22nd. Okay, same data set. So computational methods now becomes available so that people can begin to think of real-time analysis of data coming from large electrode arrays. Okay. Before learning, after learning, we are now have some of ourselves as the rat learns, we can actually begin to see little networks evolve. Okay. So this is we almost finished writing a manuscript, so it should be appearing soon. Now we want to take it to kind of a level up. Okay. Suppose I can, so for those of you who might have read, I mean, kind of seen this thing, I cannot really detect huge patterns because then uniqueness things come into the picture. So one of the ways we are thinking about conquering is to go and find sub-patterns reliably. And the way I was just using symbols, now these sub-patterns become symbols, okay? And then I can construct using alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, and so on, these kind of, this is just to say that, okay, this is my alpha-type patterns, these are my beta-type patterns. Then a pattern of this sort can then be decomposed into these things. So the same way I was thinking about symbols, now I can make these symbols into little graphlets. And so now I need to collaborate with some real graph theorists and so on. So I beg you, any of you graph theorists, I would love to work with you. Okay? Because these kind of things, at least none of my collaborators are sophisticated enough to actually formalize this thing and come up with counts that might be unique and things of that sort. But the next step is to go from, say, these three-node motifs to all the possible four-node motifs, and then go up hierarchically that way. Okay. So this is just to tell you that if I put a whole bunch of motifs in, generate spike trains like the ones that I showed you, I can actually find all the motifs. These are all the three-node motifs, I think, and I've used five different delays or something of that sort. Okay, so the kind of thing that I showed you previously is potentially possible. One of the things we had done is that for that little C. elegans network that I showed you, so we have taken that network that Mitya Sushlansky has now done quite a bit of work with, and then we artificially generate spike trains from them. So it's a 300-node network, and we randomly assign connection strengths and that kind of thing. And from that, we ask the question, how large a network can we reliably detect? So this is just to give you an idea about the largest kind of networks that we can detect at this point from that artificially generated data stream that was generated from that 300-node network. So to be honest, I think my talk should be titled Graphlet Discovery in Neural Networks, because I cannot really detect at this point large graphs. We're just beginning to create the machinery to get to that level. And I'm even worse than that. Essentially what I'm doing is what the blind man did to the elephant. I'm assuming that some of the information, well, we'll postpone that to the discussion, because I would like to have some serious discussion about information processing. So for me to get something useful out of that, for example, let's say the rat learning, the maze and hippocampus, for me to get something useful in a Hebbian sub-assembly sense, I should be using information-bearing patterns that the darn rat uses, okay? Here, I'm simply making the assumption that these kind of patterns might be useful things, and I'm getting the networks out. So in essence, the elephant that I'm getting in bits and pieces is elephant of that sort that may not be the real elephant, because and I have no real way of evaluating large models. Only thing I can evaluate are small models. These are local in nature, both in space and time. How to even hang it on an elephant so that I can get the elephant out at this point, I really do not know. Okay? I think that leaves me a little bit of time for discussion. Good. I should pay homage to all the people that actually did the work. So when I said I actually meant we, and when I said we, I meant they who did all the work. Indian Institute of Science, P.S. Shastri and I have been collaborators for 20 years or so, and some of the students who have now moved on continue to work with me. Vijay Nair is my resident statistician and collaborator. So some of the statistical equivalences that I showed you is Vijay and the BSM joint students. Casey just graduated, Koino. Dev Prakash did a lot of the programming that I showed you, and then as I mentioned, Ann Smith and Lauren Frank provided that. The bird data is a collaboration we're developing with Rikin Kazuo Okanoye's group. They have studied that Bengalese finches for quite some time. There are quite a few papers that have coming out. You can send me email, and I will be glad to send you all the things. I would like to, so this may not be a popular thing there because this was critiqued yesterday. This is a video from Andrew Schwartz's lab. So I think all of you might have already seen this thing at least 10 times. Yeah? You haven't seen it? No? So what they do is that, okay, they restrict one of the arms of that monkey, okay, and they record from the motor cortex. So this arm, this robotic arm, is actually being controlled by a prosthetic interface with the motor cortex. And you can see that the monkey eats the marshmallows quite well. Actually, he even licks the finger and so on and so forth. So one of the discussions that I want to have, okay, and so if you actually see the kind of decoding that they have done to do this, it's the Kalman filters and things of that sort. Can you provide, meaning, say, data mining schemes like what I presented, or sophisticated computational schemes? If people want to see that thing one more time, I'll play that. It's a cute video. So, yeah, essentially this prosthetic arm is being controlled by that little, I don't know if you can see the wire coming. And so the monkey learns to use this as one of its arms. So if one, if the aim in life for these kind of endeavors is to build prosthetic devices, let us say, can data mining schemes of this sort even come close to decoding? Let's say I want to discover the neural code. I don't know. Nobody's going to discover the neural code. But at least there's some decoding things that makes, say, dexterous manipulation of the arm and so on. What kind of patterns should I be looking for? Okay. So if you guys tell me these are the kind of patterns that we need to go look for, I can go look for them, find them, set up equivalent models, get you all kind of things. I would like to have at least some discussion. If one of the aims of these kind of activities is to actually build prosthetic devices, what kind of decodings would we have to do? And the other, discussion I would like to have is, suppose another aim in life is to get, let's say, head cell assemblies in the hippocampus or areas of that sort, when the animal is learning various things. What kind of patterns would we have to decode from the spike trains? Okay, let's say we all believe in spike trains, that spike trains carry information. What kind of information would that poor computer scientist like me have to extract out so that we can get, you can have some belief in the networks that we find in there. So with that, let me stop so that we have a little bit of time for discussion. I would like to have an honest discussion with this audience because I'm a poor data analyst. I need to be brought down to earth by people like you. Okay?